Over the past 25 years, writes one critic, Zaha Hadid has built a career on defying convention, conventional ideas of architectural space, practice, of representation, and of construction. And her unique approach hasn't gone unappreciated. 2 years ago, she became the first woman to be awarded the prestigious Pritzker Prize, the greatest honor in architecture. And now a retrospective of her work is being presented at the Guggenheim Museum. It opened this past Saturday, and it brings Zaha Hadid to my show today. Hello.
Hi.
Did you play a role in mounting the show at the Guggenheim?
Yes. I mean, you know, I go kind of sporadically every day, but a lot of people in my office are there, and they're helping with all the art handlers.
And what will it include? Mostly drawings and models?
Yes. I mean, also some object which we've designed more recently and all pieces. You know, we tried to really do a kind of a panorama of all the work. It was very difficult to show everything because also the nature of the work in architecture is that you have certain things which are, you know, one has to kind of really animate it a bit to make it work with the people who might not know much about it. So it's a kind of a cross-section of the work.
One of the Pritzker Prize jurors said, without ever building, Zaha Hadid would have radically expanded architecture's repertoire of spatial articulation. What can we learn from an architect's uncompleted projects?
Well, I mean, I think that when I started off, you know, like quite a few others who are, in that period in the 70s, there was not much too much work. I finished school in the late 70s. And also there was a rigor in investigation and to make the next move. Because I think that people were always either critical of some aspect of modernism, and what was emerging was historicism and postmodernism. And there were people like myself, who were, you know, Ram Koolhaas and Peter Eisenman, who really, and others, you know, who felt there are other alternatives. And
you mean, so, other than modernism, or
we did not know at the time.
Or postmodernism.
Postmodernism. So I think that it was not an intention that these built work would not be done. I think there was a resistance to all that stuff for a long time because it was, you know, decided to kind of use unconventional presentation methods and so on. But that has changed now.
But in a way, it taught people things. Rem Koolhaas, as you said, you studied with him. He seemed to specialize for a while in conceptual projects that never got built. And now some of them are getting built.
I mean, that's what I think was Sam happened with us. I think that it was not intentional that we didn't want these things built. I think I wasn't misunderstood. I think people, you know, either it was very difficult to understand them or whatever the reasons were. But I think what was interesting, they really were all about different kind of spatial experience. And I think all different methods of presentation. And I think that ultimately it led to, you know, expanding the repertoire. Because one thing which is, there were lots of competitions done at the time, and one thing which is nice about them is that, you know, you are constantly, you know, raising the standard. And so I think that all that back, that work, I think made the profession much more ambitious, and it's what it wanted to do.
What's interesting here is that many of your completed projects are not buildings. We think of architecture as a series of buildings, but you've also created a car park and a tramway, a ski jump on a mountain that overlooks Innisbrook, and some other things of that sort. It almost makes me wonder whether you are an architect in the true sense, or an urban designer, or something else.
Well, I mean, it's not true. We have this year opened 4 or 5 buildings, and they're not necessarily, I mean, a ski jump is a building of a kind, and and a kind of a tram station is a building. But we've done, you know, we've opened 2 museums, the central building, the office building for BMW in Leipzig, and also housing in Vienna, social housing. I mean, these are all, what is architecture and building? I think that, you know, there are 2 issues. At the time when we did not build so much, there was a difference between architecture and building, and I think building had to become architecture and not just the other way around. And that, I think, also made the project much more ambitious. And now we have products of every different kind. We've been very lucky because of the between brackets, the strangers of the office, that we actually get commissioned to do, you know, bridges, stations, tram stations or ferry terminals, and, you know, office buildings and housing, and many museums and concert halls and stuff like that.
Is the thinking that goes into doing all these different kinds of things fairly similar if you're an architect, or do you... is it like being a painter and then being a sculptor and then writing
a
poem?
No, I mean, I think the ideas are similar, but I think it is about, you know, also part of it is about organization. So the organizational method might change. It's more like a kind of like a composing music. You know, it's basically not all the same, but there's a similar basis. But the compositional effort and the logistic of organization makes them different, you know, or the site. You know, site, I think, has a tremendous, influence on the what the building is like, and therefore you can actually customize a building. And that is the kind of the shift from early modernism and historicism, is that the demand on you now, because of the customization issue and looking at site in a different way, that you can actually have a different solution.
In other words, not just putting a building up that's your style and then saying, I don't care what's going on around it. But what happens when you're doing something like the project you have in Bartlesville, Oklahoma, where you're developing a tower that's going to coexist with a Frank Lloyd Wright structure? That his style is very different from yours, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, the idea that, anyway, I think what the grid allows you to have is that different things occur on the grid. In the Frank Lloyd Wright building, he always intended to do something on the ground. And actually, we were very, without making it look like a Frank Lloyd Wright building, but we were inspired, let's say, by some of the ideas of the fenestration in terms of pixelation, and also the kind of very gentle ramp of the building. So it's not like the Guggenheim, but the ramping, and it's a podium. So actually, they exist very well together. And I don't think this idea, I think what is interesting also is that idea of context change. So the idea that you have to, could be contextual by only repeating the context is not necessarily what is really now, I think, critical. But I think you can actually exist within a building, next to a building, being quite different, as long as you kind of really are not sensitive in a way, but understand what you're trying to do adjacent to these projects.
My guest is Zaha Hadid, whose work has gone on exhibit at the Guggenheim Museum on Fifth Avenue between 89th and 90th Street, and will be running through October 25th. We'll be seeing models and drawings and other, I guess, videos as well of buildings and building projects, which include a Guggenheim Museum in Taiwan and lots of other interesting things. I understand that your graduation project was called Malevich's Tectonic. So obviously you grow out of modernism and out of a certain love for geometry. You were a math major, weren't you?
Yeah, I mean, geometry, I think, plays a big role. There's urban geometry. I mean, the Malevich Tectonic was an interesting project because I was in my fourth year. It wasn't my final project. It was given to us to kind of really place in a city, and I placed it in London. At the time, probably I didn't know too much about suprematism or Malevich, but that became obviously very tremendous influence on me and the work. And where it led to is abstraction, fragmentation, a painterly aspect to the work. So it was very, very critical. I think that also led to ideas of liberation from gravity and beginning to think about structure in a different way, about, you know, also the idea that you can begin to superimpose, juxtapose, and all these things together, I think, made the morphology different.
And you paint, don't you?
Well, I'm not a painter.
Because there have been architects who were painters. Le Corbusier,
yes,
probably
famous. These are really, they're painted, but they're all about a project. You know, everyone was a project. And the challenge was that at the time that I thought and we thought that existing methods of presentation were not necessarily useful for three-dimensional research and faciality. And of course, you know, 20 years later, the computer has substituted for that investigation, but it definitely helped ideas of complexity and special experiences and things like that.
Well, Frank Gehry seems to be doing a form of sculpture. You're doing painting. Would that affect the way your buildings look?
Well, I mean, I think architecture is a three-dimensional research, let's say, and you can choose to do it through models, which we do, or through drawings, and they are very elaborate sketches. They are, it's a form of investigation, and in terms of my work, it was a very useful tool to understand. You know, it's like practicing as a musician or, writing. You know, for a writer, it's the same, or a scientist. I think the research, which is done in advance of the work, takes different shapes and form till you find the way to move the next step.
You were born in Baghdad. Is Islamic architecture reflected in your work?
Not necessarily.
I was wondering if there was some secret thing, because I wasn't seeing it.
I mean,
because it's one of the greatest architectural traditions
of course,
in the world.
I think that, I was influenced, let's say, I think geometry is very, there's a influence on that. I think a lot of people think it's calligraphy because of the kind of seamlessness of the writing. I think that in more current work, because suddenly there is there's an interest in architecture about material, about, other investigation, which about, geometry and so on. And suddenly, I think now it connects more. One can connect more through abstraction and new morphology with the Islamic in a world as a way of doing projects. I mean, all the idea of kind of courtyard housing, the patio housing, which was used in the 20th century by modernist architects, was all based on patio houses in the Middle East, and I think patterning, which is also very interesting now, is also influence.
How did you wind up in architecture? You went to your university major was mathematics. Then you decided to go to London and go to architecture school. Was there some? Had you always wanted to be an artist?
Yeah, I always wanted to become an architect since I was 11 years old. And I was also good at math, so I did math, and then I decided to go into architecture. And the math degree was. The studying of math earlier was very useful for me.
Well, architecture is, to some degree, involved with working complicated mathematical ideas.
Yeah, but I think not only about the structure logic, but it's about, really, I think the logic of organization and also abstraction comes, you can actually abstract things in a different way. So it was, for me personally, it was very interesting. And I think now that we are interested also to kind of achieve these ambition projects through structure and also abstracting circulation and stuff like that, it becomes even more connected to that.
Is London a good place to study architecture?
I think is one of the at the time one of the best schools in the world, in the sense that it was a school which had no particular curriculum, there were no exams, so it was very difficult for people, when people are young, they kind of can get easily lost. But the idea that the school has all these experts and you have to tap onto them. And actually what is important about a school is that it had a fantastic chairman, and he developed, maybe others invented it, what it was called a unit system. And I think many schools now around the world actually use that system. And it was very hard when I was in the school. It was a fresh idea, and each unit had a different ideology, so you could not overlap these things. And it was interesting just being there and watching all these different things going on, which was a great learning experience.
Well, two of the leading architects of the world are out of London, but your work doesn't look like Norman Foster's, for example.
And you
haven't, even though you live in London, you haven't ever built a building in London, have you?
No, I haven't.
Do you find that odd?
I think it's very odd. I don't know why. I mean, we all speculate. I mean, people ask me all the time in London, why you do something, and it's very strange. I think that we have a lot of work in Europe now, because I think the Europeans really invest in public work, and all these projects have to be done through competition, and that has given us a chance to do them. I think it's very, even in Europe, they do corporate workers' competitions. Where, for example, the BMW office building, which we just finished a year ago. So, but I think it's less, if you're doing work for a corporation or housing, it tends to be done through, you know, friends, and I think that that is a bit tough.
Well, it's still, it's so odd. You've been awarded a Commander of the British Empire for services to architecture by the Queen.
Yes.
And you don't have any buildings in London.
Well, I will do, because we're doing a building in London for the Architecture Foundation. We're doing the Aquatic Center, the first building which was commissioned by the Olympic, for the Olympics in 2012. And also, we have now two products in Scotland. So, you know,
oh, I thought it was all Prince Charles's fault.
No, I mean...
he's set himself up as a critic of architecture.
Yeah, I mean, I think that maybe there was a resistance to anything new, because the only precedent was, and there are kind of council housing. And, you know, some of them were good, some of them were bad. You know, you can't really just base a critique on something which is done 40 years ago and not understanding that there was also, in the last 20 years, a lot of work which has been done to actually move away from not everything to do with modernity or modernism, but moving on to the next page.
Haven't you said that your architecture is influenced by how people move?
Well, not everything about it, but I think that ideas in the city, I think in a new city, and also in terms of designing public building.
So designing in New York, where people tend to walk from place to place, would be very different than designing a building in Los Angeles, where people
Yes, maybe that's the way the cityscape is organized. But I think if you talk about a project, I think it's very, because it's no longer designing, a building, occupying a building which already existed as something else. So you are thinking about a concert hall or a museum. And I think the amount of people who go to these places is no longer limited to few. And so the idea to kind of really make the experience connecting to the street and to the city very seminal to those who are using it, also the way you view space is also changed.
How do you feel your work would fit into the New York skyline?
I think it would be very interesting, because although we are dominated by the grid, I mean, the challenge to me is, how do you occupy the ground? Because most buildings occupy the ground in a similar way in New York, except in Rockefeller Center, or some of these products which actually declare the ground as a kind of public domain. And also, how do you think of a repetitive floor, non-repetitive floor? Where do you do kind of shopping? Where do you do the other facilities? And also, maybe if there's a different kind of style, one can think about maybe... doing something if it's a larger scale about how do you defy the grid, like the UN building and all these products, which are much more of an ensemble as opposed to one single extrusion.
But the New Yorker's favorite building is the Chrysler Building, which is the classic one block square building, tall but very, very nice top. Does that kind of building appeal to you?
Yeah, I actually used to sometimes stay in an apartment which faced that building. But I think one has to kind of really move on and also think about how do you deal with the ground, how do you deal with also the top, because the top is more about telling everybody, look at me, I'm here, identify the building, and the same with the Empire State Building. So I think that what is also interesting in the original skyscraper, it was not, and this is not my research, but Rem Koolhaas's, thesis on Delirious New York, which is that, these were not about repetition. It was basically, pulling the city vertically. So you can actually have a space which is more public, and you can have different life and different floors, which is not done so much anymore. And I think it's refreshing, though. There's a lot of new housing product being built in New York, and I think that's kind of exciting, because one has to kind of really think about living again.
I mentioned earlier you're designing a Guggenheim Museum in Taichung, Taiwan, a number of museums. Do they present a special problem? Because there have been any number of museums that artists have complained about. They've said they've been more about the architect than about the art.
Well, I think that, space is not only reserved for the artist. I mean, I think it would be interesting for the visitor to have double or triple experience, which is to have an interesting building, to move through it well, to enjoy it spatially, and look at great art. Of course, it is there to show the art in its best way. And I think variety in space for a museum is critical, because you have to have also be able to show such a big variety of methods and different artists, whether it's installation, because art is no longer about painting and sculpture. It's about, you know, installations, video art, and stuff like that, very large kind of sculptural pieces. So I think you need to think about variety, and also to how to show work on paper, which is very intimate and requires different lighting, to very large objects in the same space. So it gives you kind of, I think, that there isn't a central thing which you can do which is only as perfect for an artist.
The Museum of Modern Art, people complained in the past, was a little too cramped. Now it's been reconfigured, and a lot of artists don't like it anymore because they feel the art has become a little too disconnected.
Right.
Is this a situation where you can't win?
Well, I mean, I think the Museum of Modern Art thesis is about the wide cube. Now, one can say that's perfect for minimalist work or whatever. May not be perfect for other things.
Well, the rectangular paintings do perfectly well in this.
Yeah, so, but I think, you know, I've been coming to New York for the past 30 years, and when I was a student, I used to love going to the small MoMA and sit in the courtyard and see a lot of stuff. And I think that making the MoMA as a kind of corporate institution has its ups and downs. I mean, it's not perfect, and I think that so it might not be able to deal with intimate spaces in the same way.
Meanwhile, you're sharing the Guggenheim Museum with Jackson Pollock.
Yeah, I know. It's a great
That's
compliment.
A thrill. And I want to thank you so much for coming by. Zaha Hadid's exhibit at the Guggenheim Museum runs now through October 25th, and she is a great architect. I think you should try to get and see it. And also, look at those Jackson Pollocks on paper. They're fabulous. Thank you again.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure.